Available on Blu-ray or to rent.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Today is Coming up, today is tax day, and we're going to talk about one of the most significant parts of the federal budget that your taxes go for. And then later, we're going to talk about tax fairness. There's a demonstration today in Washington, D.C., trying to promote some sort of tax fairness in the U.S. As usual, your email comments are always welcome. During the early part of the show, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Well, if you look at the federal budget and you exclude self-funded programs like Social Security and Medicare, the military comprises more than 50% of the federal budget. We're all got today is the deadline to pay our taxes. The Pentagon is doing quite well this year. The military received a big boost in funding just a few weeks ago, raising its overall budget to $700 billion this year. Congress passed a spending bill giving the military at minimum an additional $61 billion in boosting its overall budget to $700 billion this year. That $61 billion increase matches or even surpasses Russia's entire military budget each year. It's more than the Trump administration originally requested. It rivals two big spending surges during President George W. Bush's administration in the years 2003 and 2008. Which went to fund the Iraq War. The Pentagon has 6 months to spend that extra money before the fiscal year ends in September. We're going to talk with William Felice, who's a professor of political science at Eckerd College. He wrote an article, an op-ed for the Tampa Bay Times a few days ago called The Myth of U.S. Military Spending. And I spoke to him earlier today about U.S. military spending on this tax day. Bill Felice, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Bill, today is tax day. Everybody's got to get their federal income taxes in, or most of us have to get them in. This is the deadline. A huge portion of what we spend on our taxes goes to the military budget. Sometimes it's called the defense budget. In terms of the benefit to the U.S. economy, overall, what are your thoughts about the U.S. military budget?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things I'd say at the beginning. One is I think we should be aware of the size of the military budget. It is what they just passed, what President Trump had proposed, comes to $716 billion. And that is a solid 13% rise from 2017. And our spending, you know, we're the world's biggest military spender. More than the next eight countries combined. In fact, this leap in spending in this budget for this year of $80 billion surpasses every other country in the world's total military budget. And that's just the increase for this year, except for China. So I think that what I think is regrettable is that we don't even have a discussion in this country about where that's going and whether it really does serve for the defense of the United States. I think that the discussion didn't happen in Congress before this was approved. And, you know, there are big issues. You know, right now the United States maintains nearly 800 military bases in 70 countries around the world. You know, maybe those are needed. I'm not sure. I mean, that costs alone, those military bases cost $200 billion. Is that serving to defend our interests? Does it serve as deterrence? I'm not sure. I think the tragedy is that we're not having that discussion.
Both Democrats and Republicans tend to vote for these large increases in Pentagon spending and military spending. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that, you know, with the exception of a few people, perhaps Bernie Sanders on the left and perhaps Rand Paul on the right, very few people question the military budget in Congress?
Yeah, that's true. I think, unfortunately, the way our, I guess they call it political reward structure works, is if you are if you are strong on defense or perceived to be strong on defense, you're rewarded. But if the perception is that you are weak and not supporting the troops, you are punished and will suffer electorally for that. I think the defense overall, you know, I think it is a public good in the sense that all of us benefit from having a secure country in the same way that when the government builds a bridge or a sidewalk, we can all walk on that sidewalk or cross that bridge. It's non-rivalrous. It's non-excludable. And defense spending is the same way. But just as when you would build a bridge to nowhere, like the controversy in Alaska, or highway to nowhere, and you're wasting money, and we don't want our public funds to go towards that type of waste, the same thing needs to be examined in defense spending. There's a huge amount of waste in defense spending that really could be addressed that unfortunately neither party is willing at this point to look at.
Bill, it's often called money for defense, but you pointed out that we have 800-plus bases around the world indicating that we're not just defending our borders, we're not defending the homeland, we've projected our military power across the globe. What do you think about using that word defense?
Well, I think it is a misnomer. I think most of this expenditure is more, at least the basis is more, I guess the word would be compellence. It's to be able to project our power abroad when we want to be able to do so. And the tragedy, again, is that if you're president, you know, what instruments do you have to defend America abroad? We cut the State Department to bare bones, and so there's few diplomatic instruments of foreign policy. And so most of the instruments of foreign policy the president would have at his or her disposal now are military-based because of this, I think, these types of expenditures. You know, I did also want to just mention there was a report about a year and a half ago that Bob Woodward at the Washington Post reported on about bureaucratic waste in the Pentagon. And his article in the Washington Post reported $125 billion in waste that they found in the defense budget. And I don't think there's any other part of our bureaucracy where that would be allowed to continue. But instead, we're afraid almost to really look and get deep into the way in which the defense budget actually works.
Has there been an audit of the Pentagon? I mean, Woodward looked into that particular aspect of waste, but has there been an overall audit of the Pentagon?
There have been periodic reports done, an overall audit, I'm not sure. It was, unfortunately for the Pentagon, as this new budget was just released last month, there were revelations again that the Pentagon had lost track of more than $800 million in construction projects in an internal audit that was done by Ernst & Young, and that was reported in February of 2018, $800 million in the latest audit of lost track of construction projects. This type of malpractice has continued, unfortunately, and the Pentagon waste has continued.
Well, we're talking with William Felice. He's a professor of political science at Eckerd College, and he's the author of the book, The Global New Deal, Economic and Social Rights in World Politics, and this is WMNF in Tampa. President Eisenhower knew all about this. He was the head of the Allied Command and helped the Allies and Russia win World War II. He knew what it meant when we invested a lot of money in the military.
Yeah, he actually did, and he warned us about the military-industrial complex and that famous quote of his about every warship that is launched as a theft from those who are hungry, that there's a trade-off here. There's only so much wealth any country has, and, you know, right now when our nation is having trouble turning on the lights for people in Puerto Rico, or helping those suffering from opioid addictions, or can't find money for education. We spend, you know, more on national defense than China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, the United Kingdom, India, France, and Japan combined. And there's something off here when we have the highest infant mortality rate of any country in the developed world, and we're not putting money there to overcome that issue, that other Other developed countries have brought their infant mortality rates down, but yet we continue to fund defense. There's a trade-off here. Some call it guns versus butter to characterize this trade-off. There's a trade-off that we're making.
Why do you think, you know, Eisenhower warned about this in the final days when he was president. Why do you think nobody has kind of followed up on that and really said, you know, we ought to look more closely at military spending?
Well, I think there is this myth that military spending is good for the economy. That overall, I think there is a misreading of history that after World War II, and because of the military spending in World War II and after this brought us out of the Depression. And that was really special circumstances that don't haven't existed since then. And in fact, some economists have estimated that military spending, every 1% of gross national income devoted to military spending reduces economic growth by about 0.5%. And the reason for that is military expenditures are designed to meet immediate goals. Investments, on the other hand, are designed for future resources, to develop future resources. And so overall, excessive, and again, I'm talking about excessive military spending, can affect negatively your economy. It can divert significant amounts of natural resources to non-productive immediate military expenses. But I don't think that's what people think. And so they think that, well, it's stimulating the economy. There's been some well-publicized innovations coming out of the military, which have been great for the civilian economy. But overall, it's this, it drags the economy down. And so part of the reason this continues and part of the reason Eisenhower's warnings haven't been heeded is this myth about U.S. spending helping the economy overall.
Well, and I think what happens, too, is that a lot of people go into the military or their sons and daughters go into the military and they come out with a skill, either, you know, a skill, they're piloting an airplane or they're really good at computers or, you know, they pick up some skill in the military. And so I think people think that that's where all of our military dollars go to, that is training people how to become better at a certain job.
Well, I think that's right, and that training does take place, and that has been positive for thousands of people where that has happened. I think the other dynamic, of course, is patriotism, supporting the troops, that if you question the size of the military budget, somehow you're a traitor. And so it's the loaded political language around even raising these issues is often overwhelming as well, and politicians are afraid to go there.
On the flip side of the training issue, then you've got things like Tomahawk cruise missiles and bombs and all these other things that just explode and don't create any benefit down the road. There's no economic benefit to exploding a $4 million missile over Syria. So I wonder if you know whether or not we spend more money on weapons or do we spend more money on personnel?
I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head. I'd have to look it up. But you're absolutely right. And so the weapons, the wasteful expenditures of weapons, it's sort of on weapons. It's sort of what I was referring to when we talk about military expenditures designed to meet an immediate goal and not a future need. And so blowing up a missile is an immediate goal, perhaps, that maybe that's needed for some immediate need, but it's not serving long-term interests of the economy. The other dynamic that's happened, by the way, is Congress often approves these weapon systems that the military doesn't want. And so there's the scandals around lawmakers approving in the past more tanks than the military had requested, more aircraft for the Air Force, more ships for the Navy, and to meet the needs of their constituencies and the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower talked about it, independent of what the military argues they need for their purposes.
Bill, I remember my parents and grandparents telling me how they and their relatives bought bonds during World War II to finance the war effort. We've continued. I mean, we've had many wars since then, Korea and Vietnam and the war in Iraq, two wars in Iraq, and then the covert wars in Central America. But for none of these have we asked Americans to buy war bonds.
Well, I think that's right. And unfortunately, what that has meant is that we have practiced deficit spending for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the increase now in the Pentagon's budget, we will go more into debt as a country. And I'm startled that we're not having a national discussion about this. You know, the deficit hawks are going away now from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Nobody's really addressing the fact that we are financing this through borrowing. These wars and this budget.
And yet, you know, if somebody goes on talk radio and says that they were standing in the grocery store line and they saw a woman using a food stamp card to buy lobster or pork chops, all heck breaks out on talk radio as people get really upset at that over an expenditure that might be $20 if it really happened. But here we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, hundreds of billions of dollars that we have indebted then a future generations to pay for a very, very long time.
Bill, there was a big anti-war movement in the 60s. You teach at Eckerd College. What are your students thinking about the cost of the military? Does that even come up as you talk to them?
It comes up somewhat in my political economy class, of course, because we analyze the budget there. But it's not, I must say, it's not a top priority, I don't sense, among students. I think the key issues students are focusing on right now are environmental issues. They're focusing on election and voter turnout and voter registration for November, and little on foreign policy at this point.
Bill, today's tax day. We want to have our freedom. We want to have our country defended. But yet, we also don't want to. We don't want to be overtaxed, and we don't want to pay for things that ultimately don't really benefit us. It is tax day. What are your thoughts on tax day?
My big thought on tax day is that. I'd like as many people as possible to really look at where your taxes are going and examine the way in which the military budget has grown out of control at this point, $716 billion as we've gone over. And that on tax day, we should be examining, you know, taking responsibility as citizens to examine whether that serves our need. Do we need those 800 military bases around the world? Are we safer as a result of it, or do they serve a different purpose that has got us involved in affairs, military affairs around the world that in the long run have negatively impacted on our country? This is the discussion we need to be having on tax day.
And Bill, one last question. You're a political science professor there at Eckerd College. How did you come to this? How did you arrive at this point where you're questioning large military spending? How did you come to that point?
I think for me, you know, my book, The Global New Deal, is on economic and social human rights, and when I saw how it really is possible to address basic human needs with small amounts of transfers of funds towards medical care, towards poverty alleviation. I see the success of these plans in countries around the world. And so I think that if you look at that and then you see where what I would call wasteful military spending is taking place, if we would transfer some of that to these basic human needs, education, healthcare, clean air, clean water, and so on, it can make a fundamental difference in the quality of life for the citizens of our country.
Well, Bill Felice, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
My pleasure.
That's William Felice, professor of political science at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, and he he's written a book about the topic that includes a chapter on military spending. It's called The Global New Deal, Economic and Social Rights in World Politics. And he also wrote a piece for the Tampa Bay Times that was published March 21st of this year about U.S. military spending. Got a couple of emails during that time. One person wanted to know the money that the Pentagon just received under the Trump administration. Does that include the servicemen and women's salary? Yeah, it does include the servicemen and women's salary. They did get a slight increase. Across the military, troops will get a 2.4% pay hike, and civilian employees of the military will get a 1.9% increase in pay. And then another email came in. Jonine writes, during Vietnam, my parents withheld their federal taxes, but they set aside money owed. In other words, there was a mechanism for social dissent. Is such a thing still in place? When I hear people not paying taxes to protest military and prison expenses, they act in a vacuum, leaving themselves open to the full force of the IRS. Where can people go to learn about protest in a responsible manner, protecting themselves legally? And there is a group called the War Tax Resisters. You can look them up online. And it's a whole group of people that withhold that portion of their federal income taxes that pay for the military because they have usually a religious objection or an objection, a philosophical objection to war. So look up War Tax Resistance, and you can find out more about that online. Well, we're going to take your phone calls and emails in a few minutes. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. We're going to take a music break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about tax fairness. Can it be achieved? This is 88.5 FM.
When I was a young man, I carried my pack, and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat, and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we sailed away from the quay. And amidst all the tears and the shouts and the cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. Oh, well, I remember that terrible day when the blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they call Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he primed himself well, he showered us with bullets, and he rained us with shells, and in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell, nearly blew us right back to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we stopped to bury our slain, and we buried ours, and the Turks buried theirs, and it started all over again. Now those those who were living did their best to survive in that mad world of dust, blood, and fire.
That's music from Pogues here on WMNF in Tampa. We're going to talk about the U.S. tax system today on Tax Day. Our next guest, Jack Pfeiffer, with a group called Americans for Tax Fairness. His group says Americans' working families are, as usual, getting the short end of the stick from the new Trump GOP tax law. Most of the tax cuts benefit the wealthy and big corporations. And our guest, Jack Pfeiffer, joins us on the phone right now. Jack, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Now, I understand that there's a big protest against the Trump and Republican tax plan today. Is that right? You're in Washington, D.C.
That's right. There are actually hundreds of protests happening across the country, and Americans for Tax Fairness, Healthcare for America Now, and an organization called Tax March are all leading a large effort to shed light on the really disparity between what working American families are receiving from the Trump tax cuts versus what the wealthy and big corporations are seeing reaping the benefits of this tax scam.
All right, so tell us how it breaks down. How are the top 1% doing under the tax plan that was voted on and approved by Congress and signed by the president? How is the 1% doing, and how are the rest of us doing?
Certainly. So it's very wild right now. The top 1% are getting 83% of the tax cuts are going to the wealthiest Americans when this bill is fully phased in. And right now, the richest 1% of taxpayers will be getting 27% of the nation's total tax cut this year. The bottom 60% of taxpayers will only get 13% of the tax cuts. It's wild.
So, and go ahead.
What's worse is that the big corporations that said that they would be providing jobs and rolling out these benefits to their workers, what our reports are showing is that that's really just not happening.
Now, we saw all those reports in the beginning that companies like AT&T and Walmart were giving big bonuses to their workers. What out of all the companies in the U.S., what percent are giving bonuses or pay increases in the wake of the tax cuts for corporations?
Certainly. So there are about 26 million businesses in the United States, and only 383 of our nation's businesses have announced any plans to share the wealth from the tax cuts with their workers through bonuses or wage increases. That means only 4% of American workers out of the 148 million American workers have been promised either a one-time bonus or a wage hike.
And where is the rest of the money going?
Well, it's shocking, honestly, Rob. Corporations are spending 37 times more on stock buybacks that benefit wealthy stockholders. They're spending 37 times more on those stock buybacks than they are on wage increases to the employees. So we've seen an announcement of over $238 billion since the tax law was passed with regards to how much money is going to these stock buybacks.
And what about investment in factories? Have these companies used that money to invest in factories so that we could have more jobs here in the U.S.?
You know, what we've found is that it's really been a continuation of the levels of investment that we've seen for the past several years. So we've not seen any significant increase in new investment in facilities.
Well, we're talking with Jack Pfeiffer, who is with Americans for Tax Fairness. He's in Washington, D.C. He's on his way to a protest against the current tax system, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. I guess, Jack, one of the odd things about this tax plan that was passed by the Republicans and signed by the president is it adds to the federal deficit. Something that I think President Trump and Republicans promised that they would not do.
That's right. It's pretty shocking here. The Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan scorekeeper on where our deficit falls. Just recently, this past week, released a report that these tax cuts will actually add $1.9 trillion to the deficit, to the national deficit. Now, only a quarter, $1.5 trillion, so that's a quarter more than the $1.5 trillion that originally was estimated for the cost of this tax law. And what is going to end up paying for this are services that middle-class, working American families depend on. So ultimately, this massive deficit increase and the debt that the U.S. will incur is going to be put on working American families. And that comes in the form of spending cuts that President Trump has proposed to health care, supplemental nutrition assistance programs that go to children and families and households. They're up to 232,000 households that will be losing supplemental nutrition assistance program assistance, and we'll see over 505,000 fewer residents will have health care coverage by 2025 due to the repeal of portions of the Affordable Care Act under this tax bill. The other programs that people are going to lose out on are disability programs, infrastructure, education, affordable housing. What's more is it looks like Medicaid, Social Security, and other major services that working Americans depend on are going to be coming under attack by Republicans in their efforts to balance this budget.
So you're saying that because the tax plan created a bigger hole in the federal deficit, it's not likely that we're going to see an infrastructure package paid for by the federal government. It's not likely that the president is going to meet his promise on having a bigger, better health care program where everybody's covered and it's more affordable. We're not likely to see that. We're not likely to see increases in education funding. A lot of schools are crying for money. We're not likely to see any of that.
No. In fact, our report breaks this down by state, so you can see what the impact to your specific state will be. At an infrastructure level, President Trump has already proposed cuts of over $240 billion over 10 years to the infrastructure programs that impact everybody's state. Those are the roads that you take to get to work, that your family takes to drop their kids off at school. Those are major issues, and every company in this country depends on infrastructure. So if you thought that the jobs weren't getting the benefits previously, when these further cuts happen to services, it's going to be an even larger catastrophe.
Jack, one last question. You're headed to a protest somewhere in Washington, D.C. today?
That's right.
All right.
At the U.S. Capitol.
At the Capitol. And what are you going to be calling for?
We're calling for a repeal of the tax cuts. And there's actually an event right there in Tampa today at 11 o'clock, so happening just this morning. And it's at the Gibbons Newman at 3321 Henderson Boulevard. And they're releasing this new report that shows the details of the breakdown there in Florida of what these budget cuts are going to look like for the average Floridian.
That's a law firm on Henderson. Do you have an idea of what you'd like to see as a tax? I mean, how would you reshape the tax system in the U.S.? Does your group have a suggestion?
Certainly. We think it's important that wealthy corporations pay their fair share so that we can afford to strengthen our communities through long overdue improvements to roads and transportation systems, to schools, and to housing, but also to making sure that people can afford their health care coverage. Then, as I mentioned earlier, over 505,000 fewer residents are going to be covered with health care by 2025 due to the repeal of the Affordable Care Act requirement to buy health insurance. So that, combined with the fact that premiums are going up by over $2,000 on average for families, the benefits of this tax plan for the average American are being outweighed by the cost that they're going to be bearing.
Well, Jack Pfeiffer from Americans for Tax Fairness, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob. Look forward to talking again.
All right. Thanks, Jack. Well, there you go. Jack Pfeiffer is with the group Americans for Tax Fairness. You can find them at americansfortaxfairness.org. Well, let's open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Bill Grace is our phone producer today. A couple days ago, I saw this op-ed in USA Today, and let me just read the opening of it. This is from Nick Hanauer, who we've heard a speech by him. He's a guy who owns a bedding business, and he's also one of the original investors in Amazon. He's worth a lot of money. He's one of the country's wealthiest people, Nick Hanauer. He wrote this piece for USA Today, and I'll just read the opening of it. That $4,000 raise Donald Trump and Paul Ryan promised, that was a trickle-down lie. He says, take it from a rich business guy. We give out raises only when we have to. Don't count on that $4,000 that Donald Trump and Paul Ryan promised from tax cuts. Free tip from a successful businessman. Always get paid. In selling you their trickle-down plan, President Trump and congressional Republicans promised you a $4,000 pay raise. This change, along with the lower business tax rate, would likely give the typical American household around a $4,000 pay raise, President Trump said in October. And House Speaker Paul Ryan said there will be at least a $4,000 on average increase in pay for American workers. And so Hanauer writes, so now that rich people like me have gotten our billions in tax cuts, you might be wondering where your $4,000 raise is. Spoiler alert, writes Hanauer, you're not getting one. Hanauer writes, take it from someone who has helped run 36 companies. Businesses don't give raises because they can. Businesses give raises when they have to. They give raises when they fear losing employees to a competitor or when the government requires them through minimum wage laws, but businesses don't give raises just because they got a tax cut. Businesses pay you what they can negotiate, and few employees in today's economy have the leverage to negotiate. And Hanauer's piece goes on to say, so that $4,000 raise Republicans talked about to sell their tax cuts, it was just a trickle-down lie. For decades, trickle-downers have relentlessly promised that if the government cut taxes on corporations of rich people like me, our windfall profits would eventually trickle down to everyday Americans in the form of higher incomes and more jobs. A rising tide lift all boats, they tell you. But the truth is, these trickle-down policies do nothing but make the rich richer. Over the last 40 years, corporate profits share of the economy has doubled, while wages share has fallen by about the same amount. That's almost $1 trillion a year that used to go to wages for people like you that now go to corporate profits and into the pockets of rich people like me. Even before these tax cuts, rich executives could have easily afforded to pay workers more. They chose not to. Well, that's a part of an op-ed that appeared on April 10th in USA Today by Nick Hanauer, who's an Amazon millionaire. I want to say billionaire. I think he is probably a billionaire. And he also owns a betting company on the West Coast. And if you want a copy of that, just email me at rob@wmnf.org, and I'll send you a copy. Nick Hanauer's piece headlined, that $4,000 raise Donald Trump and Paul Ryan promised you was a trickle-down lie. John writes this regarding taxes. He says, I'd like to see the military be self-funded, just like Social Security, writes John in Port Richey. Stan writes this, I've read that the U.S. has somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 military installations around the world, even though it sounds extreme. When you compare it to the rest of the world, which has around 40 military bases combined, it's unbelievable. Perhaps more research would be prudent. I would hope it isn't correct. Yeah, there are at least 800 U.S. military installations around the world, maybe more. I had a guest on last year who said that there's close to 900. And let's go to Debbie in Tampa, who's our first caller today. Hi, Debbie. What's on your mind today on tax day?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was just wondering, you know, they're looking for, you know, funds to lower the federal deficit. What about one of the ideas of when Congress, even if someone only has served like a small amount of time, they're compensated for life? That should probably be looked at.
Yeah, so they get a pension. I'm not sure what their pension is after serving one term or two terms, but you're right. They do get a pension for life. You know, a pension for life for a congressperson, too, is might be worth maybe a few million dollars if they live a long time. But the kind of money that we're talking about, let's say the military budget, $716 billion this year, you know, you could begin to save money by not paying all those congresspeople. But remember, you've only got about 535 members of Congress. And even if there's a lot of turnover, you might have just a few thousand members of Congress. The real savings would be when you tackle the things that cost $1 billion and up. That's where you're going to find the real savings for the federal budget. You could look at weapon systems that don't work. You could look at weapon systems that the military doesn't want. I know a lot of people would look at other areas too, but since we were talking about the military earlier, that's where the real spending is in our country. If you take out Social Security and Medicare.
Well, I'm just thinking about it. Trying to throw something out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think that a member of Congress should not have a pension, let's start there. You know, let's see if other people agree, if that's the way to significantly reduce
just,
the deficit.
You know, every little bit.
Yeah. All right, Debbie,
know,
thanks
like
a lot.
Taking taxes from us. So, you know.
Yeah. All right,
or
Debbie.
Tax cuts. Okay.
Thanks a lot. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Today is tax day, and hope you didn't have a big tax bill this year. Let's go to Andy, who's in Indian Shores. Hi, Andy. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. I'd just like to say that taxes do not fund spending when it comes to the federal government. As a fiat soft currency state, we are not constrained by things like the gold standard. And so we have the ability to spend more than we get back in return from taxes. Thank you.
All right. But Andy, who's going to do that, though? Who in Washington is going to do that?
I guess the only ones that would do that would be, new leaders that understand the monetary operations of the United States. And those are few and far between.
Yeah. So how do you change the minds of people in Washington?
Well, you've got to change it from the ground roots. You've got to start with, you know, your local citizens, because so much of the time we're told that, you know, we have to basically run the government like any household. And once most people understand that the government isn't constrained by such a thing, then they'll realize that they don't have to deal with, you know, underemployment and unemployment and the lack of resources.
Yeah. All right, Andy, and what are you doing to raise, I mean, are you going to run for office, or what are you going to do to kind of advance your cause?
I'm hoping to organize an MMT-centric forum here in the Tampa Bay area, but I would think I need a lot more support than just myself.
Okay. Andy, thanks a lot. We had two guests on a few weeks ago talking about modern monetary theory, and they put out a call to supporters, and I don't know how that went. But Andy, thanks.
Thank you, Rob.
All right. Great to hear from you, and let's go to... We'll go back to the emails. I'll read some more of these. Here's Amin, and Amin writes, the U.S. spends over $700 billion in 1 year. Russia spends $147 billion in the next 3 years. So who's the aggressor, writes Amin. And we've gotten a couple of people making donations. Thanks to Mark in Sarasota, who made a donation this morning to WMNF. Thank you. 813-239-9663. And another donation came in earlier from Anonymous. Thank you for that donation, too. This is listener-sponsored radio, so we stay on the air with donations from people like you. And people make voluntary contributions. That's how we stay on the air. And have been doing it since 1979. Well, again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. I'm also wondering... there's a controversy involving Sean Hannity, and yesterday in court, it was revealed that Michael Cohen, who is President Trump's personal attorney, was also representing, at least in some capacity, Fox News host Sean Hannity. This came as there was a hearing in New York about what to do with those records that the FBI seized from Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, and that news that Sean Hannity was one of the clients of Michael Cohen sent shockwaves, both through the Fox News Network and also in other networks, some of the other networks suggesting that Hannity was being dishonest, because for the past few weeks, Hannity has been a very strong critic of the Mueller investigation and the raids, on Michael Cohen's office, Donald Trump's personal attorney. So culminated in Alan Dershowitz, who's been on Fox News these days defending the president against Robert Mueller's investigation, and Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, criticizing Sean Hannity live on the air. Let's dip in and listen to a little bit of what went on yesterday when Alan Dershowitz, who has been very favorable to President Trump and to Sean Hannity, suddenly took Sean Hannity to task. Let's see if we can bring this up here without too much interference.
Well, first of all, Sean, I do want to say that I really think that you should have disclosed your relationship with Cohen when you talked about him on this show. You could have said just that you had asked him for advice or whatever, but I think it would have been much, much better had you disclosed that relationship. You were in a difficult situation,
obviously. If you understand the nature of it, Professor, I'm going to deal with this later in the show.
Yeah, I understand.
It was minimal. I understand.
You should have said that, and that would have been fair to say that it was minimal.
Look, you were
in a tough position because, A, you had to talk about Cohen, and B, you didn't want the fact that you had spoken to him to be revealed. And you had the right, by the way, not to have your identity
I have the
revealed.
Right to privacy.
Right.
I do.
You know, it's a complex situation when you're speaking to millions of people.
It was such a minor relationship in terms
of
with real estate and nothing political.
I understand that.
All right. So that was Sean Hannity taken to task by Professor Alan Dershowitz last night on Fox News. Dershowitz saying that Hannity should have disclosed that Michael Cohen had acted as an attorney for Sean Hannity. Hannity has been doing some of the dirty work of Michael Cohen by blasting the Mueller investigation on the air. So what do you think about that? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. The big question that raises is, should Sean Hannity be on the air? He is on a channel that's labeled Fox News. So ostensibly, what they're presenting is news and not a conflict of interest. Do you think that because he has an apparent conflict of interest that Sean Hannity should be removed from Fox? What do you think? 813-239-9663 and our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Jackson Palm Harbor, and he said, just look at what Senator Brownback did in his state, and we will see what the rest of the nation will be like. Every major service was cut in Kansas. Taxes are what we have to pay to live in a civilized society, writes Jack, who's in Palm Harbor. And Brownback's no longer governor there, too. He was appointed by President Trump, I think, to an ambassadorship position, so he's no longer there. And Bill in Pinellas Park writes this. He says, only a damn fool would believe that the tax plan would help anyone, but the uber-rich should pull their head from their butt and wake up. You and I will support their cost of living increase, while you and I will see no benefit whatsoever. That's Bill in Pinellas Park talking about the tax plan. All right, so there's a lot on the table we could talk about, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. Let's go to Ron in Lutz. Hey, Ron, you're on MNF. What would you like to comment about?
Hi, Rob. Yeah, you've had, you know, one of the guests talk about it in order to pay for these huge tax cuts for the rich that Trump's, you know, just passed, that he's been proposing huge budget cuts, you know, on the poor, meaning pretty much the rest of us. And that's what I've been worried about more than anything for quite some time. I know back in February now, right before the Parkland shooting, he proposed this really terrible budget that was pronounced dead upon arrival, that had huge cuts to Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps. For food stamps, the proposal was just to send people a box of non-perishable items, you know, just the same stuff you got sitting around the house in case there's a hurricane or a power outage, you know. And I'm wondering, whatever happened at any, what's going on with any of these wacky budget proposals? any chance that any of this stuff is going to get passed this year, or have they already got, you know, the budget set for this year? I heard they actually increased domestic spending for this year. I heard the other day Lisa reading a report on the early morning news that they were going to drug test people for food stamps. What's going on with the war on the poor? Can we expect any huge budget cuts this year? Will it be next year? Do you know? Or
well, this the guest that I had on, his group says that SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that used to be called food stamps, Trump's cut to SNAP could cost more than 5 million households their benefits in 2019, and 5.5 million households could lose benefits by 2028. I think, you know, we got to keep in mind too, Ron, that the people that are on food stamps, many of them are the working poor. They already
many
work.
Are also and, old people, and retired people.
Exactly.
No
do you know, Ron, do you know retired people? Can I ask you, do you know retired people who are on food stamps?
I'm sorry?
Do you know retired people who are on food stamps?
Yeah, but I'd rather not say, because then you'll just have callers calling in, tell me to get a job and stuff like that. And I just, you know, I can't work anymore. So I just, you know, was wondering, are we looking at any cuts to, like, Medicare, Medicaid?
Well, Ron, let's talk about, if you don't mind, how old are you?
I'm coming up on 61 next year.
Right.
I'll be 62, and I think I'm going to have to go ahead and take my Social Security next year before Trump can get a chance to mess around with that.
Did you work all your life?
I was going to wait till I'm 67, but I figure I better take it next year.
Yeah. Did you work all your life?
Yeah, up until about several years ago. Then, you know, I started getting sick with vertigo, and I tried to get disability but couldn't get it, and so
did you work with your hands, or did you work
it was a desk job. Yeah, I'd rather not get into my
well, the only reason I ask is that, Ron, I think a lot of people think that if you're on food stamps you're living large, and I was looking at the food stamp numbers the other day, that people who are on food stamps get less than $2 per meal to live on food stamps.
It depends on your monthly income as the way they do it. You every year or every 6 months, you got to fill out a big, long application. You got to put down all your income from all your sources. You got to send in your proof of income. They want to make sure you're not dealing drugs or being a crook and stuff like that. Then you get a little plastic card, you know, you go to the grocery store and swipe it, and it will only pay for actual food items that are food stampable in the store. It won't pay for beer or cigarettes or gas or any of that stuff. It's basically how it works. So
do you feel like you get enough food to eat based on your
I'm doing okay for now. I'm just worried about future budget cuts. I'm okay for now. This isn't even about me so much. There's people, lots of people worse off.
Well, Ron, the only reason I ask is that oftentimes we don't really hear from people who are on food stamps, and you're on food stamps, and I just wanted to share that with the public.
Callers like Rocky the Plumber calling in tell us to get a job or start.
You know, unfortunately, Charlie the Plumber has passed away. So
yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. All right.
Hope it wasn't some Mexican or Muslim killed him. I know he was scared.
No, I think something else happened to him, and I'm not sure what it was. Ron, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Okay, great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Now, Brian writes this. He says, federal taxes are not like states or municipalities. The federal government is the currency issuer, and the issue currency at any amount at any time, as long as there are resources, able workers, and it does not create inflation. That's Brian, who was one of our guests on a few weeks ago, talking about a modern monetary theory. And Ty writes this, I think Hannity should go off the air as soon as Stephanopoulos does, seeing how Stephanopoulos worked for Bill Clinton and never disclosed until caught his donations to the Clinton Foundation. You would have to remove many news people if you're trying to do away with conflicts, writes Ty. I think people are concerned about Sean Hannity because only when he was forced to admit it did he admit his ties to Trump's attorney. I saw a great documentary years ago about George Stephanopoulos running the first Clinton campaign, where the slogan in that office was, "It's the economy, stupid." I think Stephanopoulos's ties to Clinton are acknowledged and pretty well known. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we'll get the latest news from NPR. And unfortunately, Mark Bureau is still recovering from his surgery. We'll have more on that after the top of the hour. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg.